should go ahead with Representative Bernardi's bill, House File 2516. Okay. And Mr. Poser. To your bill, Representative Bernardi, and we'll make the motion later.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm here today to bring forward the technical bill from the Secretary of State's office. We will have Mr. Poser walk through the bill with you. Just want to make out a couple points here. Numbers 10 through 13 on the House Research Bill Summary List, those happen to be what I think of the unsession work that we're doing this year in the Minnesota House. And they were things that a lot of this had been taken care of last year regarding the color of ballots, and these had slipped through the system, and we're going to clean those up this year. The other ones, Mr. Poser will lead us through and let you know what they all contain.
Mr. Poser,
just introduce yourself. Chairman and members, Gary Poser, the Director of Elections for the Office of the Secretary of State. Just to lead you through some of the summary of the changes in House File 2516. Section 1 clarifies that employees of residential facilities do not need to be eligible to vote in Minnesota to vouch for, to vouch as employees of the facility for voters that reside in the facilities. This is a clarification, and it's important for the border communities where residential facility employees may not be Minnesota residents and therefore not eligible to vote. Section 2 reduces paperwork by providing the Secretary of State with the authority to maintain records of safe-at-home residents in the statewide voter registration system without the need for each of the 87 county auditors to delegate this authority to the Secretary, as is currently occurring. Section 3 is a technical correction to account for legislative changes made last year to make all absentee ballot periods uniformly 46 days long, except for the township elections, and this just provides that the master lists are ready at the beginning of the absentee period. Section 4 requires county auditors to send ballots to military and overseas voters by express mail if they miss the deadline for sending out the ballots. Basically, having this provision in state law would be helpful with the Federal Department of Justice if any counties happen to miss sending out any ballots. Section 5 provides a start date for write-in candidates to register to have their ballots counted, and it coincides with the beginning of the late filing period for jurisdictions that don't have a primary. Section 6 adds step parents to the list of relatives prohibited from serving as an election judge in the same precinct, kind of going along with previous changes with step siblings and step children. Section 7 and 8 are technical corrections made for legislative changes last year that will allow mail ballots to be processed on the same timeline as absentee ballots, basically allowing the envelopes to be open and fed into the ballot counters 7 days before the election, which is what is currently now allowed for regular absentee ballots. Section 9 is a clarification of the Voters' Bill of Rights to make it reflect the time off allowance in Section 204C.04, and that time off allowance only applies to state and federal elections. As Representative Bernardi commented, Sections 10 through 13 are just removing obsolete references to colored ballots. Section 14 mirrors language found in Chapter 412 for statutory cities, basically clarifying that for charter cities as well, officers would continue in office until their successors are qualified. Section 15 standardizes the affidavit of candidacy for municipal offices. Section 16 prohibits a school district from holding a special election on the date of the March township elections if the school district includes a township within its district that has an election on that date. For these school districts, it shortens the windows, that prohibition window around the township election, during which school districts currently are barred from holding a special election, reduces that prohibition from 56 days down to 30 days prior or before or after the election, but then it prohibits them from holding a school district special on the March Township date itself. This is needed because the March Township elections have a different absentee ballot length period. They have different polling place hours, and many of them are exempt from requiring the use of accessible voting equipment, and that causes some issues whenever a school district is having an election on the same date. Section 17 provides in statute the form of the question to be used in the case of a recall, as other ballot questions are specified in statute. And Section 18 standardizes a ballot question in the common yes and no format that's been done at other in other places in statute. And I believe there also was an amendment.
Oh, yes, we do. We can't
Thank
move
you.
It
we
yet.
We can't move it, okay. but yeah. would you be willing to discuss, Representative Bernardi, the A1 amendment?
Okay.
Or Mr. Poser.
Yes. Basically, the A1 amendment, there are three sections in the amendment. Two of the sections deal with the same putting ballot questions in yes and no formats. And the other section clarifies that records, if a voter requests their record to be removed from the voter registration system, that's not actually deleted, but that it's just made inactive, retaining the actual data from that record without it being physically deleted from the system. And with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions on the bill.
Okay. Highly, highly controversial.
Yes.
No.
Apparently.
We can't move the bill, we can't move the amendment, but we can ask questions or entertain questions and testimony. First, let me ask, I don't see any questions here. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill? Anyone in the audience? Okay. Any member questions, comments, concerns? Okay, we don't have a quorum, so we can't act on it. So thank you for your testimony. I think what we'll do is just go on to the next bill. Okay. We'll come back to this and act on it.
Okay,
thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Next,
we have House File 2531, an equally controversial bill, I think.
I did get four of them on the way.
Thank you, Representative Lane. To your bill.
All right, and again, we can't move on it, but this is a technical bill for the Campaign Finance Board, and Jeff Segerson is here to explain the bill.
Mr. Segerson, just introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jeff Segerson, Assistant Director of the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. As Representative Lane said, this is basically a technical correction and hopefully non-controversial bill. With your permission, I'll quickly go through the various sections. Section 1, throughout 10A, there's various references to at what point a number becomes in play. And throughout the statute, we prefer to have it more than a particular number. For example, you disclose a contribution or expenditure when it's more than $200. There were a few places within the statute where that term wasn't used, so for consistency's sake, we're moving that change. In Subdivision 5, you'll see that change throughout the bill. Section 2 is dealing with the definition of candidate. You may recall in 2013, the requirement to register a candidate's committee with the board occurs when they either raise or spend over $750 within a year on that effort of being elected. However, the definition of candidate still referred to 100. For consistency's sake, again, we're raising that to $750. Section 3 is dealing with the, again, a change that occurred in 2013, but which wasn't made throughout Chapter 10A. That was where it was a change in the standard by which the board issues findings from probable cause to believe that a violation occurred to a finding of fact and order and conclusions through the findings. The standard which the board has moved to is a higher standard than the probable cause standard. However, there were, again, a couple of places within Chapter 10A where that language change was missed. This is one of those cases. Section 4. Again, as a reference to the concerning probable cause, removing that term. Section 5 is one where I'd like to step back and do a little bit of an explanation. Currently, the board provides campaign finance reporter software, which is software that's available at no charge to candidates, political committees, and party units to file electronically their campaign finance reports with the board. That application is PC-based. I apologize. That application is PC-based, and all the data resides on the hard drive of the PC until that time that a report is electronically sent to the board. However, there are difficulties in maintaining a system which is PC-based. Number one, it doesn't work very well on a Mac computer. Two, Windows changes their operating system on a fairly regular basis, and we've found it difficult to maintain a system that works over the various XP, Windows 7, Windows 8 environment. So in the future, the board believes it will be advisable to move to a web-based application where a treasurer logs on to a username and password protected entry screen on our website, and enters in the information there. The problem is that currently, as soon as they enter in that information, whether or not it's available to the public or not, if it's residing on a government-owned server, it could be seen as the type of data that should be or could be accessed by the public. This is changing it so that that data is not government data, and that includes for the board as well. It's not data that we have any access to. It will be encrypted, and availability to that data will only occur when they submit a report, and even then it will only be the information that is required to be in the report, not information that doesn't meet disclosure thresholds. So this doesn't have any immediate effect, but it allows the board to get into a position where 1 or 2 years from now we can start developing a web-based application and moving away from a PC-based application for the filing of campaign finance reports. Section 6 is providing a little bit more leverage to the board. Currently, if a report is submitted without a violation but simply missing information, the board then sends a notification saying, for example, you forgot to include the address information or maybe the employer information of a contributor or a description of an expenditure. That's not necessarily a violation, but it does have to be amended. That information does need to be provided. The current penalty here, if they don't meet the requirement to provide an amendment within 10 business days, is only $5 per day. And frankly, we no longer find that as an effective tool to get prompt amendments in a timely manner. And we would like to go to $25 a day, which is what you will see in terms of penalties for late filing fees, both for the lobbyist program and the campaign finance program. So this is just being consistent with other late filing fees throughout the statute. Section 7 is providing a new enforcement procedure for the board. This is dealing with the reconciliation problem became obvious to the board, where we didn't necessarily have the information needed to reconcile contributions made from one registered committee to another registered committee. Currently in 10A, there really isn't an enforcement process. It's not like we can say that that's a required amendment, because almost by definition, one of the two committees that reported to us is correct, and we don't know which one's correct. So here we have basically a provision that requires them to respond to our reconciliation outreach when we say that these two contributions match. Please provide information. We can no longer be ignored, and we believe this will allow us to again move through the reconciliation process and resolve that issue much quicker. It provides again a $25 a day penalty if they don't respond to the reconciliation request. Section 8 is adding clarification. You may recall in 2013 some additional offices were added to the economic interest disclosure, namely judges and then county commissioners outside the metropolitan area. There was some confusion as to when those statements would be filed with us. This clarifies that it's within 60 days of assuming office for both those county commissioners and judges. In Section 9, this is an exception to the EIS disclosure statement that was, again, added for judges, dealing with senior judges. I guess I would say that from the board's perspective, there's an administrative hurdle here that is at least has to be considered. With judges, we don't expect them to provide their home address. We expect them to provide their business address, their chamber address, so that we can reach them through that method. Senior judges are retired judges who come back into the system to provide fill vacancies in terms of somebody being on vacation or perhaps an extended illness. And they don't really have an address at the chambers where they can be reached. So administratively, it's more difficult for us to reach those individuals. This provision was brought to the board's attention by the Minnesota District Court Judge Association, and I believe Nancy Haas represents that association, is here and could answer any questions on that as well if you would like.
Before we go on, Mr. Sigerson, we do have a quorum. So, Representative Blaine, if you'd like to make the motion on your bill, just so it's properly before us.
Okay, I move House File 2531 be re-referred to the
Civil Law Committee.
Civil Law Committee. And I would also like to move a short amendment, the A1 amendment. It just simply clarifies who does not need to file a pre-primary election report.
Okay. Any discussion on the A1 amendment, members? Okay. Seeing no discussion, all in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. as you were saying, Mr. Sigurdsson.
Section 10 is, again, dealing with the issue of becoming more than a certain amount as opposed to 50,000 or more. We're now going to be consistent and say more than 50,000. Section 11, you may recall, again, in 2013, the disclosure level was increased from over $100 to over $200. However, this reference to when dues or membership fees paid to a union, political committee, or fund are disclosed was missed. This is making it consistent and saying that they will be itemized on a report that goes over $200. Section 12 is the where the amendment was just now placed in. This is basically dealing with a series of reports that are required by candidates. There were basically two problems that we're resolving here. The language looks perhaps a bit more convoluted than it really is. One error was that constitutional officers and appellate court judges were required under the existing language to file 6 reports a year, even if they were not on the ballot. They were required to file every state general election a year, and of course that's a 4-year office, so they would be filing 6 reports even on a year in which they're not on the ballot. That problem has been corrected. And the second problem was also dealing with the idea that the board does not believe it's necessary for candidates who have an office who is on the ballot, for example, a House candidate who is not going to file for office either because they intend to terminate or perhaps are going to run in 2 years from now. There's really no reason to have them do the full filing period schedule, and so this changes it so that if you're not on the primary ballot, you don't need to file all the reports, just the year-end report. Section 13 is dealing with the 24-hour reporting period. This, again, is where large contributions are reported during the within 24 hours during that 2-week period, basically between when the pre-primary report is filed and the primary election, and then again between when the general election report is filed and the general election. The current statute says that you're going to do that if you have a contribution that's over 50% of the election cycle contribution limit. That should say segment. A cycle is all 4 years, for example, for a constitutional officer, or for a Senate candidate, it would be $2,000 because they have $1,000 for each of the 2-year segments. This makes it a segment contribution limit, so now a Senate candidate will be disclosing within 24 hours that they receive a contribution of over $500 versus over $1,000. Section 14 simply requires that we publish the information on expenditure limits on our website and distribute it through that as opposed to the state register. Section 15, again, is another reference to probable cause that wasn't removed in 2013. Section 16 is a companion language to what we talked about earlier with the board's ability to have a website-based campaign finance reporting system. This modifies the reference to campaign finance reports and data in Section 13.607. Section 17 is in 211A02. I believe this is at the chair's request. It deals with the fact that most local candidates do not establish a separate checking account for their campaign committees. They're not required to under 211A. They may keep the money for their campaign in their personal accounts, and therefore you need the language, it's better to have the language designated to be used for political purposes. That allows the beginning and ending cash balances to make sense and not be the same as the total bank account of the candidate. Also, the terms contributions and disbursements is defined in Chapter 211A, while receipts and expenditures are not. So to use terms that are defined within the chapter, we're using contributions and disbursements. Finally, Section 18, the repealer, is attached to the bill. This is a tool which the board has never used and frankly doesn't feel comfortable using. It allows the board to find, other than a member of the legislature or a constitutional officer, to find that if they fail to file their economic interest statement, that they can, by the board, can suspend that person without pay. That was not a tool that the board's comfortable using, and frankly would prefer not to have. I believe that's all the sections. Again, Ms. Haas is here if there's any questions on Section 9. Otherwise, I'm happy to answer any questions board or the committee may have.
Okay. Any member questions? Comments? I do have one. Ms. Haas, I just want to make sure, just so we get the position on the record about Section, I think it was 9. You just introduce yourself for the record.
Sure.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members, Nancy Haas with Messerly and Kramer here on behalf of the Minnesota District Judges Association.
Yeah, could you just explain, Ms. Haas, what Section 9 is and kind of the rationale for it? I think Mr. Sigurdsson had said there was some administrative concerns, that sort of thing. I just want to make sure that we get your full version, I suppose.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. Well, you will recall from last year, Representative Hansen had a bill that was intended to bring in all elected officials not currently included in the economic interest statement. So judges were included in that along with county commissioners. Although some areas of that we thought were duplicative, we certainly did not want to be against transparency. So one of the things, though, as we were looking through implementation with the Campaign Finance Board, was this issue of getting information to senior judges and trying to get that information to and from them in a way that protected their security interests. In the dialogue last year, there was some availability for the economic interest statement on a second home, for example, to allow a judge to not provide that if there was a security interest. And as you know, in other areas, when you file for office, a judge can use their work address. And so really the administrative part was, unless you were going to go through the court administrator in every judicial district to communicate with retired judges, it was just going to be, I think, cost prohibitive in that respect. And as it relates to how senior judges become senior judges, you know, they're appointed every 2 years by the Chief Justice and then serve for 2 years. Now, when judges leave that status, you can be reappointed. And so really it was an issue related to trying to find an ease of administration and as well as protecting a security interest in an unusual circumstance that we didn't really anticipate until we were trying to figure out the implementation of the law from last year.
Okay. I just wanted to set the record straight. Any questions for Ms. Haas? Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone from the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill? Sir. Just state your name for the record.
Oh, yeah, Bob Auden with the Libertarian Party of Minnesota. Was it having the government look over campaign contributions is like having the fox watch the hen house. I've had at least one case where you still have the contributions for $100 or more where the name and so forth has to be disclosed, and where that information was used, and then the city inspections department was sent on them and closed down their business. It has a habit of drying up contributions. If you can't get rid of that, at least raise it. You've already raised other dollar amounts in here. Raise that from $100 to $500.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Auden? Thank you, sir. Anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill? Any other final member questions, comments, concerns? Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you be willing to go back over kind of the difference that we're switching to now with the board on lines 3.28 and 3.29, where the board's moving from probable cause to findings, conclusions, and orders? Can you talk about the differences and what that will mean?
Mr. Sigurdsson.
Chairman Simon, Representative Sanders. This was actually a consistency change. It was already made in 2013, but my understanding is that the probable cause standard is basically more likely that something is true than not, and the board has never really used that standard. It's always based its findings on facts that it is able to determine and then apply the law to those facts. So with that being the higher standard, and it is a higher standard than the probable cause standard, the board moved to that to be able to issue findings, and this is just a case where the change, which was was made in 2013, simply wasn't caught in all places in Chapter 10.
Great. Thank you.
Any other member questions, concerns, comments? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Lane renews her motion that House File 2531 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Lane. Members, I think what we'll do, I see Representative Hansen is here or was here. There he is. But before we get to his bill, what I'd like to do is move. We didn't have a quorum before, but move. Well, I'd like to move Representative Bernardi's bill. Or you can move it, Representative Bernardi. I think it's going to the General Register, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 20. No, first we'd have to amend it. Excuse me.
Right. Well, but just make maybe just make
okay,
the
like
motion and then we'll
make a motion to move my House File 2516 to the General Register.
Okay. And then you had an amendment, Representative Bernardi. And for members who came in, Representative Bernardi already made the presentation on the bill. It was very quick. It was utterly, I think it's fair to say, technical and non-controversial. So no one's trying to slip anything past anyone here, but there wasn't a quorum, so we moved on to the next bill. That's why we're just doing it like this.
Okay.
So you had an amendment, Representative Bernardi, and it's number?
A1.
A1. Okay. That's right. So do you want to move the A1 amendment?
I'd like to move the A1 amendment and amend House File 2516.
Okay. Any questions on the A1 amendment, members? Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bernardi, I apologize. I heard I missed a dynamic presentation earlier. So would you just very briefly explain what your amendment does and how it changes the overall bill?
Okay.
Representative Bernardi.
We're going to go up
here. Or if
here.
You want to defer to Mr. Poser.
Mr. Chair, we're going to go up.
That's
sure.
Fine.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Sanders, the A1 amendment has basically three sections. Two of the sections are simply removing or changing ballot questions to actually put them in the yes-no format as other sections of statute refer to. And then the other section is clarifying that records are no longer, voter records are not deleted from the statewide voter registration system, but if a voter asks to have their record removed, it's simply inactivating their record and not physically deleting it from the system.
President Sanders?
Okay.
Any other comments or questions on the A1 amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Now we'll go to the bill itself. Any other member questions, comments, concerns on the bill? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Bernardi renews her motion that House File 2516 be re-referred to the General Register. As amended. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Bernardi. We're now ready for Representative Hansen. As he's coming down, I'll entertain a motion. Looks like Representative Sanders has a motion to approve the minutes of March 4th.
So moved, Mr.
2014. All in favor of approval of the minutes of March 4th, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Representative Hansen, welcome.
Thank you.
To your bill, please. Oh, you know what? I'll move your bill.
Okay.
I'll move that House File 2567 be recommended to pass. I'm sorry, that House File 2567 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. This is an important Hansen-Drazkowski bill, a bipartisan bill.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Let that settle for a
Mr.
little
Mr. Chair, if I might.
If, Driscoll.
Be suspect of this bill, members. Be very suspect of this when cats and dogs start playing together.
Representative Hansen.
So this is on an issue that I discovered kind of inadvertently because I send out holiday cards in my district. And if you send out holiday cards after the election, they count as campaign expenditures, which is kind of difficult to understand because you've already had the campaign. So if you send the card out, and I know some members send Thanksgiving cards out, I have holiday cards. So the bill, House File 2567, says that the holiday cards after the general election in that year are non-campaign because you may have reached your limit and then you couldn't send out seasonal greetings or Thanksgiving cards or holiday card. So that's all the bill does, is it makes those non-campaign versus campaign expenditures.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this forward. I like the idea of this. I just want to clarify and tighten up what you just said. You said after the general election or after the election, so post-general election is actually current statute, for the remainder of that year. But I don't see that it says that anywhere in here. It may. I tried to briefly kind of read back through all of statute. But I just want to make sure that, I mean, post-general election doesn't mean like July 4th and so on.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sanders, that is my intent. It should be only that year by December 31st of that election year. And I don't know if that requires an oral amendment or Mr. Gehring.
Mr. Gehring, first, I'd like to hear kind of your understanding of that. And second, I think we could reason. I have the same concern as Representative Sanders. I think we could reasonably, on the fly, construct an oral amendment that limits it to December 31st after the election year. So it would apply also to thank you notes or advertisements in the news media until that date or some such limitation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sanders, I think that's the way this language operates currently, but Mr. Goldsmith is here from the Campaign Finance
Sure.
Board. He might be able to.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. And both Representative Hansen and Mr. Gehring are right. That is the way that the board interprets and applies this particular non-campaign disbursement, because the election cycle for a particular candidate ends on December 31st of the election year, and January 1st would be the beginning of the new election cycle, which would mean we would then be before the next election. So an amendment wouldn't hurt, but that's the way that we interpret this, just based on the words of the statute.
Representative Sanders.
Mr. Chair, I guess I will just ask the question to you and Mr. Gehring, the author. If that's the way everyone interprets it, and we kind of have that on the record here, I guess I'm fine with that. Do we need to have clarifying language in there?
Representative Bernardi.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I'm just thinking that, you know, we now know in this little small committee, and there's not very many of us here, a lot of times when people are candidates, it's not clear to them and they don't understand. So I think anything to add clarification is helpful. I mean, hopefully they'll call the Campaign Finance Board, but I know they're limited with resources. It'd be better to have it be as clear as possible. So that's my recommendation.
It seems to me that's safe and utterly non-controversial if we can do it. Mr. Gehring, do you think we could fashion?
And Mr. Chair, I'm open to that. I think having it specific is better. You know, 5-10 years from now, we don't have to worry about intent. It's clear. Plus, it would probably save this discussion on the floor whenever the bill gets there.
No.
I don't want to spend a half an hour debating
right.
that.
Well,
because my intent is really, hopefully, this is something that's relatively non-controversial.
I think it's a good catch by Representative Sanders. Oh, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to weigh in on that, and forgive me when I make this comment. About 30 years ago, we had a situation in the state of Minnesota, and how I know this is it happened in my district. The candidate who was elected died about 3 days after the general election, and the governor called for an election that actually occurred because it was an election year, so that we could have the newly elected start with the rest of the legislature. My question is, how would that work? The general election for November was done. I don't see anything in here that identifies general election. I think the assumption is it's the November general election, but there could be a special primary election and another general election that could go over the holiday season that could be a question mark or confusion for potential candidates in those isolated situations. Having said that, I also know that last year we did some clarifying language on that process, and I have not had a chance to go back and to see how this might stack up and to see if that's a problem. I only want to bring that up as an issue so we don't have an issue like we're looking at right now.
Oh, Representative Driscoll, that's a great historical footnote. My hunch is, but we'll ask Mr. Goldsmith, that the language post-general election on 2.15 is pretty commonly understood as the November election, and that the kind of election you're talking about would be a special general versus a special primary, is my hunch. But Mr. Goldsmith, is that What's your take on that?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. When we look at elections, we look at special primary elections and regular primary elections, but if the word primary election is used or general election is used, it could apply to either one. And this particular non-campaign disbursement we interpret as applying only to the people who were actually on the ballot, not on the ballot, but the offices for which were on the ballot for that election. So, for example, if the House is up every 2 years, it would apply every 2 years to the House, but it would not apply every 2 years for constitutional offices. So I think we apply statutes to special elections on a fairly regular basis because they do come up. And so this statute would apply to people who were in the general election as the way you all expect it to. And then if there were a special election that also ended before the end of the the special election has a special election cycle end date, and we would interpret this as being applicable in a special election up to the special election cycle end date, just like in the general regular election where it's applicable to the election cycle end date, which happens to be December 31st.
Okay, that's a fair point. It sounds like maybe not as much of a need for clarification, but that's an excellent point. These things can happen. Mr. Gehring, can we check in with you? Do you think you might have a formulation that could work?
Mr. Chair?
Oh,
If we're considering now special elections, if we do put a date in, then the language probably won't work for special elections because they typically aren't going to be ending around the end of the year, but that's something to consider.
Okay. Representative Helps.
Mr. Chair, to that point, one of the other issues that I was wondering about is that the holiday season for some extends longer than December 31st, and so perhaps we could clear up both questions with a number of days rather than an end date, 45 days or something like that. Or I would also, if we did want to go with an actual date, extending it into January somehow.
Mr. Chair, yeah. Just on that point, I think the key is that the campaign year, not the holiday year, is the calendar year.
Right.
So the expenditure occurring in the calendar year, I mean, if we did, as Representative Halverson was saying, that would upend a wide variety of issues because you're having the expenditure then change into the next year. So I have been slow sometimes and have mailed on the 31st a seasonal card. That's why I have a variety of folks in my district call them seasonal cards or holiday cards, but I have mailed them on the 31st so that that expenditure is in that year, even when it is a campaign bill.
Mr. Gehring?
So, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, I think the proposed amendment that I've worked out that might work is on page 2, line 16, after media, insert, mailed or published prior to the end of the election cycle. And as Gary has discussed, there is a definition of election cycle in statute that does cover both special elections and general elections, so they should be able to easily determine what the date would be for the deadline.
Mr. Gehring, could you repeat that one more time just so our CLA can?
Sure. So this amendment would be page 2, line 16, after media, insert, mailed or published prior to the end of the election cycle.
Mailed or published prior to the end of the election cycle.
And we say mailed or published because there's also the reference to advertisements in the news media.
Right. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative,
not that I really want to wordsmith this, but if we take the word the and make it an election cycle, does that take us into special elections and generally in the regularly scheduled general election? Because the is pretty prescriptive and becomes more of a generic applicability.
Mr. Goldsmith, any comment on that?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, we would apply it to the election cycle that the mailer is in, so it could be a special election cycle or a regular election cycle, and it would only apply to whatever election cycle the person was in. And this language that Mr. Gehring has produced would it reflects the way we handle the matter now.
All right, members, I think we have, I'll move that oral amendment then. I'll move that the oral amendment that on line 2.16 after the word media, we add the words mailed or published prior to the end of the election cycle. Any discussion to the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Any other discussion to the bill as amended, House File 2567? Anyone in the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill? Okay, seeing no. Representative Hansen?
Thank you, members of the committee, and I'd invite any of you to join on the team bill here, the Hansen-Draskowski election bill. If you'd like, you all can join in. So.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 2567 be re-referred to the General Register.
I don't know if I can move that.
I will renew my motion. Pardon me. I will renew my motion. It was my motion that House File 2567 be re-referred to the General Register as amended. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Thank you, members. The meeting's adjourned.
Thank you, Representative Sanders.